This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents You Are a Mogul, How to Do the Impossible, Do It Yourself, and Do It Now by Tiffany Pham. Read by the author. To my father, mother, sister Kim, and brother David, for being the most amazing, supportive family. Thank you for believing in me and us every step of the way. We are where we are today because of you. You're not just a woman. You are fierce. You are bold. You are unique. You are brilliant. You are motivated. You are driven. You are empowering. You are inspiring. You are a mogul. Introduction. 4 years ago, I sat in my bedroom and began creating a digital platform for women across the world. I wasn't outrageously ambitious about the numbers of women I would initially reach. I was a 27-year-old business school grad, working 3 jobs at once. But I decided to try to build this idea I had on my own, in the hours I had to myself, after my jobs were finished each night. Over a period of months, I taught myself how to code, showing my fledgling site to a few people for feedback. And then I sent it out into the world, unsure of what its impact and reach might be. But I was hopeful it could become a vehicle to show women exactly how much we are capable of, that when we come together, we can rise faster, go farther, and truly change the world. That platform ended up becoming Mogul, the company that I now run today, with offices in New York City, San Francisco, and Paris. One of the largest platforms for women worldwide, Mogul reaches millions of people across 196 countries through its mobile app, the web, email, social media, books, TV, films, and events. Thousands of jobs are posted on Mogul each day. It offers award-winning unconscious bias, inclusive leadership, and gender equity trainings. It addresses safety at work through cutting-edge harassment reporting tools. Fortune 1000 companies are pledging to Mogul that they will improve how they present women in their communications. For every dollar Mogul earns, the company provides free educational resources to women in need through international partners such as the United Nations. And though we find ourselves today at the pinnacle of success, it didn't come easy, and it didn't happen overnight. My journey, and the journey of Mogul, was fueled by unending determination and resilience, no matter how challenging the circumstances, a perpetual desire to learn more, become more, and the knowledge that, step by step, you can do anything you want to do and be anything you want to be. So if you've ever been laid off, shut down, told no, doubted yourself, or been doubted, then look no further. Welcome to our Mogul world, where all of that is about to change. It doesn't matter how old you are or where you are starting from. Anyone can become a mogul, especially you. If you're thinking that it's not possible because you just don't fit the powerful businessman stereotype, spoiler alert, that's not what a mogul is or looks like anymore. It's true. Before I launched Mogul, when you Googled the word mogul, the top search results were links to businessmen like Warren Buffett and Rupert Murdoch. But today, when you Google the word mogul, we are the number one search result. A community of women across the globe, connecting, sharing, and striving to change the world. We are redefining the word for the next generation of girls to know that they too can be moguls. We all have the power to create something great. Whether it is a social enterprise, a nonprofit, beautiful artwork that inspires the world, or technology that makes people's lives easier. I share my story and the story of Mogul so that you can apply every lesson I have learned to your life today, accelerating your own growth personally and professionally, and reaching your goals sooner than you thought would ever be possible. And while I may seem polished from the outside in my heels and power dress, know that I'm not all business. Deep down, I'm still the underdog, the one who didn't believe in herself, the shy girl who moved from Paris, France to Plano, Texas, struggling to learn a new language and adapt to a new culture all at once. But through the years, I've learned to step up to the moment and to not let self-doubt hold me back. Though I've been compared to Fortune 500 CEOs, that's just not me. I'm used to marching to the beat of my own drum and to being the youngest in the room, the only female in the room, or the only Asian in the room. I've figured out how to not let that or anything keep me from accomplishing what I set my mind to. Even if others said no along the way, I never let that stop me. I've consistently made choices that led me to overcome obstacles and achieve new heights much faster than expected. Choices that I want to share with you so that you can learn to do the same. You also hear from 10 of my friends and the most powerful moguls worldwide, including Nina Garcia, Star Jones, Rebecca Minkoff, and more. They share their personal stories and insights so that you can adopt their learning too. Before we get started, a brief disclaimer. I've tried to the best of my ability to recall everything that happened in these pages accurately, but I am human just like you. I might have gotten a date slightly out of order. I surely hope I didn't misremember a name or memory, but know that this book is my best attempt to put forth the truth of my life and the creation of Mogul while respecting certain people's privacy. And know this too. Within you lie the courage and confidence to do what hasn't been done before, a voice that we desperately need to hear, and the ability to see problems and devise innovative solutions in a way that can truly impact the world. Becoming a mogul isn't about becoming rich, although that is a pleasant side effect. It's about thinking for yourself, identifying and embracing your unique strengths and passions, and using those to make the world a better place. When we fully step into our power, there is no predicting the heights we can reach. Chapter 1. Pinpoint Your Passions. In many ways, I've known what I wanted to do with my life since I was 14 years old. That was the year that the course of my life changed, as you'll learn soon. The events that took place then led me to decide, at that time, that I would do everything I could to help others. I would dedicate my life to not only showing others what they could strive for, but helping them to achieve it. That goal became a guiding force for me, a promise to myself that I aimed to keep as I went forth in the world. Pinpointing that passion early, and having something that I was doggedly pursuing from the age of 14, allowed me to rise and become a mogul at a young age. I envisioned the course that I wanted for my career, and said yes to opportunities that I thought might help me get to my goal. I was continually focused on this goal, even though I didn't know exactly what the path might look like. In fact, it was that willingness to not know the exact path that allowed me to get there faster than anyone could have predicted. How did I get to be so driven? I had powerful influences throughout my life that shaped me to dream big, learn everything I could, and strive for excellence. Those influences were the fuel that kept me going. They reminded me of what was possible. Whether you're 14 or 40, it's never too early or too late to dream big. When you have a passion to keep you going and role models to inspire you, there is no limit to what you can do. Fail forward. I was born in Paris, France, to Vietnamese and Chinese parents, and thus grew up speaking a combination of languages, including French and Vietnamese. My early years were idyllic. My older sister Kim, younger brother David, and I spent our days riding our red tricycles around the fenced-in courtyard of our house eating buttered crepes on the Champs-Élysées, and skipping by the Château de Vincennes. Like my favorite scenes from Amélie, but with more pho. Then when I was 10, my family moved to Plano, Texas, and suddenly, my life transformed from a scene from Amélie to an episode of Friday Night Lights. It was a land of pickup trucks, McDonald's, and American football. And we loved it too, despite the differences. I remember my childhood in Texas fondly now, but at the time, I did worry whether I could ever fit in. Thanks to my startlingly bright braces, thick-rimmed glasses, and bowl cut, I'd say my worries weren't completely unfounded. Plus, I was extremely quiet in school, not just because of my innate shyness, but because I did not speak English well. I didn't know how to communicate with my teachers, let alone my classmates. My mother worried about me as she watched me come home from school in color instead of doing my homework. I still couldn't read any of the worksheets I was sent home with. But even though those first few months were challenging, I would later see that time of ongoing transition as a pivotal part of my story. In their younger years, my parents had often spent entire days at the theater in France, where they showed screening after screening of black and white American classics. This was the genesis of their love affair with America, and their appreciation of classic American cinema continued when we moved to the States. We often had Turner Classic Movies on after school. My parents knew that the more we were exposed to the language, the quicker we would learn. As a result, I grew up watching women like Audrey Hepburn and Marilyn Monroe show me how elegant, charming, but also powerful women could be. And while I slowly began to pick up English and engage more with my classmates and teachers, I was also glimpsing how powerful media could be for learning, for showing you what was possible, and I never forgot that feeling. I'm thankful now for how those early years of having to adjust to a new language and a new culture allowed me to learn how to belong anywhere, to be curious about new places and new ideas, and to be ready and willing to incorporate new perspectives into my growing worldview. Because to be a mogul, you have to see outside your current situation and be willing to engage with the world, arms wide open to accept its lessons, its differing beliefs, and its varied paths to influence and impact. The world is the greatest school there is if you are open to its education. My father and mother were exemplary role models in this regard. Despite the fact that they had to rebuild their lives not once when they immigrated to France, but twice when they then moved their family to America, I never saw my father and mother discouraged. I saw them push forward, always, no matter what difficulty lay in their path, seeing each new challenge as an opportunity to learn something new. Even as they had to find new jobs and new homes as we traversed the world, they never let anything defeat them, all for the family. They embraced change and new experiences, and they raised their children to be truly engaged with the world around them. In time, with each new city I moved to, and each new job I took on, whenever I would face challenges, my father would remind me. There is no such thing as failure, as long as you are moving forward, as long as you're learning. In the end, you're succeeding. True failure is not doing, not trying. So fail forward, and you'll always find yourself where you're supposed to be. My father, in particular, was relentlessly curious and constantly challenging himself to do new things. That passion for learning was passed on to his children. My parents let my siblings and me try anything we might be interested in. If we didn't like it, we could move on to another activity. If we loved it, we were encouraged to become the best we could be. There were probably a half dozen interests that I left behind before discovering my love of taekwondo, lacrosse, violin, and piano. On the way to various practices and lessons, in our red Nissan minivan, my father would play audio tapes by Dale Carnegie, the author of How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. Dale's voice was the soundtrack to my childhood. How lessons written in the 1940s by a 60-year-old man from Missouri felt so relevant to my life at the time, I don't know. But whenever my father was driving, Dale's tapes were playing in the cassette player, and I loved listening. Just like my father, Dale taught resilience, positive thinking, and self-improvement. I grew up with this unstoppable spirit and dedicated determination as the backbone of my family. And just like certain traits can be passed down from generation to generation, so can passion, so can curiosity, so can kindness and resilience and perseverance. That belief in forward momentum, risk-taking, and the constant pursuit of your dreams cultivated in me early on was the foundation for me to become a mogul today. Building resilience. It's not always easy to buy into the idea of failing forward. But if you can, like me, learn early on to stay focused on the forward momentum, you'll build incredible resilience that will serve you in all areas of your life. Look back on your life, at moments where you felt like you failed. Now think about what lessons you took away and what doors opened because of that failure. You tried, you learned, and odds are, you became that much better because of it. Whether it is a job you didn't get, or a college that didn't accept you, or an opportunity that seemed to slip through your fingers. I, like my father, have come to see that it is not about the missed opportunity, but what you did in the wake of said failure. If you ultimately found a different job, enrolled in a different school, or searched for a similar opportunity, you could still get to just as great of a place as if life had gone entirely according to plan, if not better. Anytime you feel like you failed, exercise your resilience. If you can just stay focused on all the assets you gained and momentum you now have for moving forward, you'll find that in the end, with perseverance, that failure will turn into a success story. Don't be satisfied with the status quo. By the time I reached high school, I'd finally learned English well enough that my accent was receding. My grades at the time were good, but they weren't stellar. I was too busy with the social scene and making it through each day to dedicate myself to studying. I would never earn a score of 100% on anything. I would often get an A-, and at a very competitive public school, this was far from the top of the class. My freshman year, at a math teacher who would have his students grade each other's work so that at night, he wouldn't have to grade all 30 papers. In that class, I sat behind a girl named Diane. She was kind and soft-spoken. When we would trade papers and I would grade her work, she always got 100%. Every time. She would then pass my paper back to me and I would have scored a 92 or 93. As the days went by and this kept happening, something took root in me. Why was I settling? Clearly 100% was possible. If I was going to put in the time to complete the work, why not put in that little bit of extra effort if it meant a perfect score? Why was I selling myself short? I made the decision. From now on, if ever I'm going to do something, I might as well try to do the very best I can at it. So I started to study. Every night, I would sit down to my math assignments and commit myself to getting 100% myself. I wanted to be more like Diane. And it worked. I started getting 100s. As my grades improved, Diane would turn around and hand my paper back to me, smiling. She could tell something had changed in me, and she was rooting for me. She knew that me trying to do my best didn't diminish her. We could both excel. Diane and I soon became best friends and would spend hours studying at each other's houses on the weekends. Together, we were eventually ranked in the top 1% of our class, of more than 1,000 students. A decade and a half later, I was a bridesmaid in her wedding. We still talk and laugh every day. This was a pivotal experience in my life because Diane made it apparent to me at the ripe age of 14 that I had two options. I could push myself beyond what I thought was possible and perform in ways I couldn't have imagined, or I could be satisfied with the status quo. Because of her example, I decided to strive for excellence, and this philosophy began to impact other areas of my life. I infused passion into everything I did instead of settling for things as they were. Step by step, through incremental daily progress, I began to train night and day for my black belt in Taekwondo. I practiced drill after drill to make the varsity lacrosse team, And I rehearsed for hours until I made first violin in orchestra and was awarded top honors in piano. That was my first lesson in learning that achieving the impossible is usually possible with hard work and unwavering dedication. When you set yourself up for success, you often surpass what once seemed impossible. Not just for grades or accolades, but because there is no better feeling than doing your best, whatever your best might be. Right there are the seeds to what I would eventually create with Mogul. You can be more than what you believed you could be when you find examples to follow. And sometimes, those examples are sitting right in front of you. Follow in her footsteps. I had another such role model for excellence in my grandmother. I'd grown up listening to our family stories of all my grandmother had accomplished in Asia, anecdotes of her courage, kindness, and endless generosity toward those around her. My grandmother was a force of nature, a bold pioneer. She was among the first women to drive a car in Vietnam. She didn't let restrictions hold her back. At a time when other young women around the world suffered from lack of opportunities, she owned businesses across industries and would provide jobs to others in need. She was beloved by all and committed to helping the masses. She was a maverick of her time and an inspiration to me, as well as to the family that surrounded her. It was a beautiful portrait of what a woman could be. She was a mogul in every sense of the word. Once we moved to Texas, we were able to more easily visit with my grandmother, who had also moved to the United States by this time. I'd heard about her my entire life, and it was amazing to finally spend time with her. She was no longer just a legend to me, but a flesh-and-blood person, a loving matriarch who would do anything for her children and grandchildren. Being able to see this woman in person and witness her kindness and generosity is one of the most powerful memories of my childhood. In my young and impressionable mind, it made sense to me then how my father had grown to be such a strong, kind, and giving man, and why he cherished those same qualities in my wonderful mother. I so wanted to be like them. Sadly, within several years, my grandmother passed away. I remember vividly the moment when my father let me know. After initial moments of silence in our house, I went into a small closet and curled up on the floor in the darkness. And as sadness washed over me, I remember saying, "I promise I will make you proud. I promise I will make my parents proud. I promise." In that moment, I vowed that I would do everything I could to follow in my grandmother's footsteps. I, too, wanted to be a pioneer, shattering people's expectations and being a role model to others. I, too, wanted to provide opportunities to those who needed them and break down barriers. I would dedicate every waking moment to this goal, no matter how challenging. I was still a teenager, braces, glasses, bowl cut and all. I didn't know exactly how I would accomplish that goal or what it might look like once I did. But from that moment forward, my mission was set and the course of my life was changed. Creating paths of possibility. Everyone needs an example to follow, a guide for the way forward, a trailblazer who isn't afraid to go where no woman has gone before. Women need to see other women being successful in positions of power and having a global impact. Together, we create paths of possibility for those that come after us. Becoming a mogul means realizing that you are not alone in this world, that there are people who have gone before you to show you the way. Find others who inspire you, who keep you focused on what is possible. Vow to follow in their footsteps so that others can follow in yours. That commitment will keep you going even during the hard days ahead. Be flexible yet strategic. By the time I applied to colleges, I was beginning to crystallize how this goal might materialize. I wrote in my essays about how my family inspired and influenced me and reiterated my promise to follow in my grandmother's footsteps. With each paragraph written, my dream began to take shape. Seeing how a role model had given me so much to strive for and allowed me the opportunity to dream, I vowed to create a company that would provide such examples to other women worldwide. I knew that it was vital to showcase the accomplishments and inherent strength of women in order to enable the next generation of girls to know that they could be bold and daring and could pursue positions of impact and influence. With each of those applications and essays, I developed a storyline for my life, a narrative that had a beginning, middle, and hoped-for ending that likely allowed me to stand out from the crowd. Whether you think about it this way or not, every application you fill out, every job interview you walk into, and every resume you send is a story of who you are and all the things you bring to the table. And you have to sell that story. Yes, you have to sell yourself. Showcase the fact that you're going places, with or without them, and it will truly set you apart. This is an incredibly powerful tool for achieving the impossible. I applied to 4 schools, including Yale and Stanford, without ever visiting their campuses. I was hesitant to spend my parents' hard-earned money traveling to visit the campuses, in case I didn't get in. As the months wore on, large envelopes finally arrived in our mailbox. I'd been admitted to each one on scholarship. My father and mother wept with joy at the discovery. I'd largely kept the application process to myself, not wanting to disappoint anyone else if it came to that. So when they opened the envelopes with me, one by one, it was quite the surprise. I dreamed of attending Yale during hours watching Gilmore Girls. I admired their brightest student, Rory Gilmore, who didn't have to be the loudest in the room to be the smartest in the room. She had a quiet confidence and lofty ambitions that she wouldn't lower for anyone. Remember how she said she wanted to be Christiane Amanpour? But when April of my senior year arrived and college decisions were becoming due, I was suddenly drawn to the idea of playing lacrosse at Stanford. My parents, meanwhile, were happy to support me no matter what I decided, though in their hearts, I knew they hoped I would select my first love. Fairly certain I would attend Stanford, I decided to attend their admitted students' weekend, the same weekend as my senior prom. It wasn't an easy decision. There was a huge part of me that did not want to miss out on this pivotal part of American high school culture. I wondered whether I would always look back and feel a gaping hole at the center of my high school experience. But I think, even then, I knew that there was so much life ahead of me, so much of my future that would be determined by the decision of where I went to college. So I helped as my friends tried on dresses and cheered others on as they accepted dates, and I tried to stay focused on where I was going, on the future I was building. My father flew to California with me, but as soon as I walked on campus, something felt off, or rather, everything felt right to the point of feeling wrong. I felt such a sense of familiarity with the weather, the attire, the students I met. I didn't feel afraid, like I would be pushing myself beyond my comfort zone. On the final day of admitted students weekend, my father and I were in the souvenir shop buying Stanford t-shirts for the rest of the family before flying home. When we exited the shop, my father turned to me and, smiling, handed me a check for the document fee that would confirm my spot at Stanford. "This is a gift for you, from your mother and me." I looked at him gratefully for a moment, then surprised even myself by saying, "Actually, I think I need to attend Yale." My father exclaimed joyfully, while simultaneously being in shock. Here we were in California, having missed my prom, the event every senior had been looking forward to all year, so that I could get started on my time at Stanford. I must be mistaken. But I knew I wasn't. I needed to attend Yale, to travel to the cold Northeast and be among buildings and people so different from what I had known before that I would have to confront any fears and trepidations. The environment, the culture, would be so different that it would stretch me, embolden me to do more of the unthinkable. I watched my father as he ripped up the check he had written, and when we got back to Texas that night, I mailed in my acceptance to Yale. I trusted my gut then, as I still do now. It hasn't failed me yet. All of my friends were shocked when I told them the news, and I was surprised too. But when you are willing to let go of your hard and fast notions of where life is supposed to take you, you open up to all the other opportunities that might be right around the corner. The truth is, flexibility is one of the greatest skills you can develop early on. I'm sure I don't have to tell you that the corporate landscape is changing, and very few of us will work for one company forever. Instead, more and more people are pursuing what journalist Farid Chidea calls the episodic career. There is no longer one roadmap for a good life, personally or professionally. And while that provides for greater freedom to find our way, we have to learn to be as agile as the GPS on our phones, recalculating our route, our wants, our actions, sometimes a dozen times a day. We live in a time when there is no longer one path to success, but that means that you should always be checking in with what feels right, true, and authentic for you. What do you want? What do you love? Where does your passion truly lie? So here's a guideline that has been helpful for me as I navigate the twists and turns of life that don't always go the way you planned. Be flexible, but strategic. Know what you want. Know where you want to end up. But don't get stuck thinking that the path to get there is set in stone. Set your destination, but be adaptable in what route you took. I use this approach when I travel as well. I've often been on planes to Oslo or Dubai or Panama City, with nothing but a list of spots that I definitely want to visit, but I won't have a firm itinerary, filled to the brim with plans that prevent me from the fun side trips that are often the most rewarding and exciting part of the trip. There will be a cool-looking alleyway that could lead you to the kind of experience you are craving. If you only think there is one path to your goal, you're going to find yourself frustrated by how long that narrow road seems, and passing up opportunities that could take you exactly where you hope to go. I've tried to be someone who says yes to many things, looking for different ways that side trip, or that unexpected opportunity, or job, might enable me to learn more, stretch me further, enable me to develop the relationships and skill sets to move faster toward my goals. I call these moments accelerators. They are choices that I made and experiences that I had, which catapulted me to the next level. In my early years, these accelerators helped me develop my passions and home in on what I truly loved to do. Later in life, I focused on accelerators that would allow me to build skill sets that I would need in the job I knew I wanted to pursue. But the willingness to be open to opportunities along the way, flexible yet strategic, has been one of the most important accelerators on my career path. Create your storyline. I was lucky enough to determine a storyline for myself at an early age, but it is never too late to stop and think about the story you want to tell. What problem is it that you are trying to solve? What is the passion that drives all the various jobs that you've embarked upon thus far? Find a way to describe your career path, even if it has been non-traditional, as a part of a storyline that has an interesting and purposeful narrative. It will not only help you on applications and job interviews, but also might help you as you try to make decisions about what steps to take next. Where are you trying to end up? What is the ending of your story? And what could you do next to get you there faster? Solve the problem yourself. Your future will be born from the opportunities you take advantage of today. And while the specific ones that present themselves to you can depend on where you were born, the family you grew up in, and what rights, privileges, and experiences you have been given, there are countless opportunities that you can go after yourself. You don't have to wait around for them. As my good buddy Dale Carnegie says, and I've updated on his behalf to include women, the woman or man who grasps an opportunity as it is paraded before her or him, 9 times out of 10 makes a success. But the woman or man who makes her or his own opportunities is, barring an accident, a surefire success. I learned this firsthand my sophomore year at Yale. During my freshman year, I'd struggled to find my place on campus. I'd insisted on New Haven after all because it would force me to face a very different culture from that in Plano or Paris. I was up for the challenge, but navigating my new life on campus was more than I had bargained for. It took me that entire first year to push past the struggle, constantly doubting that I could ever be as smart or as talented as my classmates at Yale. As a result, that first year, I never raised my hand in class. I was close with my roommates, but struggled to meet anyone apart from the other students in Brantford, my residential college. When I got back to campus my sophomore year, I vowed to not allow another year to go by without taking steps toward getting involved in something, somehow. Soon thereafter, I found my opening. I joined the board for the Asian American Students Alliance as their webmaster. At our first board meeting, the discussion centered on a racist cartoon that had been printed in the previous week's issue of the Yale Herald. The other board members were livid, threatening to hold a protest outside. Meanwhile, I flipped to the back cover of the newspaper and found a full-page advertisement announcing in bright green that the Yale Herald was recruiting for a financial analyst. That's when it occurred to me, instead of holding a protest outside, what if we could fix the problem from the inside? My father had always taught me to be a doer. In difficult circumstances, try to resolve the issue at hand through problem-solving and action, not just discussion. Thus, while Asa continued to discuss how to address this cartoon, I was suddenly considering joining the newspaper. I realized that if I joined and thus diversified their staff, I could help ensure that they would not print a racist cartoon again. I emailed the Yale Herald publisher that night, and to my delight, she immediately set up a meeting for the next day. As I sat down with Jane, the publisher, inside local favorite The Buttery, I learned that it wasn't just the Yale Herald lacked a diverse staff, they lacked a complete business team. There were just two people essentially running the newspaper, and the racist cartoon was the least of their issues. Due to mismanagement from prior years, the newspaper was in significant debt, debt that was increasing with each printed issue. The school was keeping the paper afloat, but at a significant loss. I was an economics major, so helping the newspaper staff figure out their finances would be an interesting challenge for me, and a way to get involved in publishing. They were thrilled to add me to the team. They handed over their books and essentially trusted me to start pulling them out of their dire situation. This was my first crash course in company management. A company must succeed on all fronts to become a success. You can have the best content in the world, but if your company isn't financially sustainable, you aren't going to be around for long. For the most part, the newspaper staff focused on content and getting the paper produced week after week. They ran a few ads each week, but they were from Yale organizations and brought in little revenue. The Yale Herald was distributed for free, so the only way to bring in more money was to sell more ads. Now, if Jane had sent me a job description of the financial analyst role at the newspaper, I doubt it would have said anything about selling advertising. But if you want to get ahead, you can't simply fulfill the job description. You have to do more than what is expected, for everyone's benefit and for your growth too. In other words, if we were going to save the newspaper, then I had to roll up my sleeves and do whatever it was that needed to get done. No questions asked. Immediately. Even if that meant doing something I had never done before. Selling door to door. Over the course of the next few months, I raced to speak with local businesses that might be trying to attract a collegiate clientele. One of the first places I stopped at was called York Street Noodle House. It was a cozy, delicious Asian restaurant that had just recently opened on campus and that I thought might be perfect for my first pitch. When I walked in, I asked to speak to the manager, Soraya. As I got her attention, I made a personal appeal, telling her about how I had recently joined the paper and why it would be advantageous for local businesses to advertise. She looked at me kindly and, much to my surprise, said yes and placed a quarter-page ad. I couldn't believe it. My first ad. I tried not to look so shocked and lose the sale. I was so grateful, and I promised that in return, I would bring friends into the restaurant whenever I could. Eventually, I came around with friends so often that she bought another ad, and another ad. Soon, she had bought a year's worth of ads, and I, in turn, had brought nearly my entire residential college to York Street Noodle House, Its popularity spread. Business took off for both of us. I next sold to Toad's Place, our local dance club, and soon thereafter secured the support of Yale agencies and establishments. When firms such as Goldman Sachs and McKinsey & Company came to recruit on campus, I would stop by their events and forge relationships, and they would later request to buy advertisements in the Yale Herald. After one more semester, Jane retired, having reached term limits, and I was promoted. By the spring of junior year, I'd become publisher of the Yale Herald. I immediately undertook measures to further cut costs by finding a lower-cost printer, reducing the use of color ink, surveying the campus to see where the newspaper was actually being read, and redistributing the newspaper toward those areas. These cost-cutting measures required a close collaboration with the editorial team, and the strengthened bond helped us to revitalize readership. As morale lifted, word spread across campus, and the size of the business team grew from 2 to 10 to 30. With more team members on board, I was able to divide us into different teams, Yale agency sales, local sales, and national sales. And with a lot of hard work and an enterprising spirit, dollar by dollar, we brought the newspaper from near bankruptcy to record profitability. The team rejoiced. Don't wait for the perfect opportunity. I know firsthand your future depends on your willingness to say yes to opportunities, even if they don't look perfect, and to go after what you want with everything you've got. Becoming the publisher of the Yale Herald was definitely a dream come true. But it didn't fall in my lap. Nothing truly good ever does. I had to work for it and be willing to say yes to an opportunity that wasn't 100% perfect on paper, but was a chance for me to get involved and learn. If I had seen the posting for financial analyst and pushed it aside because it wasn't exactly what I was looking for, I'd never have met Jane, stepped into that role, learned how to get beyond my natural shyness to sell, and ultimately found myself at the helm of a newspaper at 20 years old in order to lead it from bankruptcy to profitability. Very rarely will your dream job be listed on job boards, but if you know what your ideal job is, find another way into that organization or industry. Excel at what you are doing, and you'll find yourself reaching your goal faster than you ever imagined. This is yet another example of being flexible, yet strategic. Evaluating opportunities. If you are having trouble determining whether an opportunity is right for you, take a moment to answer the following questions. Number 1. What skills could I learn from this job that I don't currently possess? Number 2. What people could this opportunity put me in contact with that might lead me to something promising in the future? Number 3. What's the worst that could happen if I take on this role and it doesn't work out? I had no idea those years working at the Yale Herald and bringing it back to profitability would be a key talking point on my resume after college, giving employers the confidence that I could have a more senior role in their organizations than they would typically have given to a recent college graduate. Yet, it was an accelerator that demonstrated to them I was ready to roll up my sleeves, just as much as my formal college internships at Electronic Data Systems and Goldman Sachs. Despite the fact that I was young, my role at the Yale Herald proved that I had already taken the reins of something and steered it in the right direction. Your path will obviously look different than mine, as will your goal, but know that with the right people inspiring you and a willingness to look for opportunities at every turn, you too will be able to home in on your passions and realize your dream. Hashtag you are a mogul. Follow in the footsteps set by someone you admire and keep your eyes peeled for the many opportunities that could be accelerators. Learn to say yes, even if the job doesn't look perfect. It's the specific experiences and opportunities that you create for yourself that will become your calling card. Hashtag I am a mogul by Dr. Jen Walter. the first female NFL coach. I never set out to make history. I never set out to be the first anything. My only goal was to pursue my love of sport, and that sport happened to be football. But growing up, I wasn't allowed to play because I was a girl. When I got to college, I started playing rugby, which was as close as I was going to get. And then I started playing flag football, and eventually found a women's league after college. It was such an incredible feeling to get to take the field for the first time as a woman and play the sport that I loved. I didn't set any limits on where football could take me. I loved it. The competition, the camaraderie, the challenge of a group coming together to achieve a single goal. I pursued this passion of mine despite the fact that I was the only girl. Football was what I loved, and I pushed myself to be the best and a part of this experience in any way I could. After I finished my doctorate in psychology, I wondered what it would be like to bring the knowledge that I had acquired and a woman's perspective onto the coaching staff of a team. It had never been done before. That didn't mean that it wasn't time for it to be done. What's important about my journey is not the fact that I was the first to infiltrate the boys' club that was the NFL. It's about knowing that your opportunities as young women are not narrowed because of your gender. And if anyone tells you different, I've already proved that they are wrong. We need to remove the ceiling society has set in place and know that we have the capacity to do anything we put our minds to. If there aren't any opportunities out there in the field that you love because of your gender, make those opportunities yourself. I enjoy sports, and I of course love football, but I am no different from any of you listening to this who have passions of your own. I've simply removed any barrier trying to prevent me from taking the next step, and my journey hasn't stopped yet. Yours hasn't either. Chapter 2. Value Your Voice. No matter what you hope to accomplish with your life, whether you want to create your own company, rise to the ranks of CEO, solve a problem in the world that is begging for a solution, or just live a life of purpose and meaning, to get there, you've got to learn to speak up. You've got to recognize the power of your voice, the value of your ideas, and that your perspective is urgently needed. Yes, you may face stereotypes or biases, but only by developing confidence in who you are will you be able to break these down. Commit to valuing who you are and remaining authentically yourself across all aspects of life. The fact is, whether you find yourself in the classroom, the conference room, or the boardroom, you may often look different, think differently, and talk differently than those around you, but that doesn't mean your voice isn't valid or essential to the conversation. You bring something important to the table. Your perspective is invaluable. And the more that you rise up and demand a seat at the table, the more diverse that table will be, so that hopefully, one day, it will not be notable whether there is a male leader, female leader, or minority leader at the head of the table. There will just be a leader, you. Weigh next steps carefully. I'd always planned on going to business school as part of my path to creating my own company, but struggled with when would be the right time to attend. I remember all too well, as graduation from Yale drew nearer, I began to increasingly question what would be the right next step in this journey. I wrote down this existential question as I prepared the speech I'd been asked by classmates and professors to deliver at Yale graduation in front of 10,000. I know, me, the shy girl, I was honored by the vote of confidence, but also sincerely hoped I wouldn't stutter on stage. In the speech, I tried to channel our class's collective optimism, but uncertainty. I quoted lyrics from Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer, the song that famously closed out Toad's Place each night, and which a choir joined me on stage to sing during the speech, surprising and delighting the audience. I knew what I wanted to do in the long term, but it was only, quote-unquote, halfway there. Where should I go from here? By the end of senior year, I'd received a full-time offer from Credit Suisse for a two-year analyst program in mergers and acquisitions where I would be able to hone my financial skill sets. I hoped to focus on companies within the technology and media sector so that I would be able to learn to read their financial statements and understand their business models from a strategic level. Given my eventual goal to start my own technology and media company, this seemed in line. But I also kept wondering about business school. At my father's encouragement, I began to study for the GMAT during spring break. I had just 7 days to prepare before the test date, and I grew increasingly nervous as the days passed quickly by. I'd been scoring low on practice test after practice test. The night before the GMAT, I tossed back and forth in bed all night. But thankfully, when test time came, I realized that the practice tests were actually many times more difficult than the actual GMAT. The adrenaline and focus kicked in, and when my score arrived, it was high enough that I applied to my first choice, Harvard Business School. It was during our senior class trip to Myrtle Beach, just days prior to graduation, that I got the notification. While a dozen friends from our graduating class were sleeping strewn about the floor of our hotel room, casualties of a late night out, my close friend Susanna pulled up next to me excitedly. I clicked on the email. I had been admitted to Harvard Business School. I called my father and mother to tell them the unbelievable news. They cried tears of joy and pride, thrilled that I had this opportunity at age 21. But there was a part of me that knew I needed more time and experience before attending. My gut was telling me that as much as I wanted to go to HBS, Harvard Business School, there would be a time for it. And that time was not right now. I wondered if HBS would allow me to defer for 2 years so that I could work at Credit Suisse in the interim. I didn't want to turn down the spot at HBS, but I knew that the opportunity to learn more about finance would be invaluable. Fortuitously, HBS agreed to deferment, and the next 4 years of my life were subsequently planned out for me. It was fortunate that I paid attention to my instincts. By waiting 2 years, I was still one of the youngest in my class, but now I had some real-world work experience under my belt. My 2 years working at Credit Suisse in New York City flew by, filled with overseas trips, late-night dinners, financial models, and more PowerPoint presentations than I could count. I'd met some great people, really sharpened my financial skills, and knew that New York City was a place where I wanted to live again. But I was so excited for this next part of my journey. Soon enough, I found myself, suitcases in hand, settling onto the Harvard Business School campus and moving into 1 Western Avenue, apartment number 621. I was now 23 years old. While I had certainly learned a lot working in the world of finance, I still arrived with the naivete and wide-eyed enthusiasm of Elle Woods in Legally Blonde, minus the pink wardrobe. Don't let age hold you back. My decision to go to business school was a key part of my journey that gave me the confidence to speak up in a room full of people unlike me, to find my voice, and to figure out how to stay authentically true to myself, even when I looked and acted different than most of the people in my industry. It was a time of growth, discovery, and confidence building that I know accelerated my growth as a leader and future entrepreneur. But you should know that going to business school is not essential to becoming a mogul. You can certainly have a successful career without an MBA. However, I do encourage any woman who so desires to pursue a business degree. It is, after all, one more way that we can work to establish parity in the workplace. Experts say that more women getting MBAs is key to both closing the CEO gender disparity and addressing persistent systemic issues, most important, the gender pay gap. The statistics are so well known that I probably don't need to quote them, but I will do so anyway because they are worth emphasizing. Caucasian women earn 80% on the dollar compared with Caucasian men for doing the same job. And for women of color, the statistics are even more dire. 63% on the dollar for African-American women, and 54% on the dollar for Hispanic women. Over the course of your career, that can add up to $500,000 or more. Or, as I recently saw in a Washington Post article, by the end of October, if you are a Caucasian woman, you are pretty much working for free for the rest of the year. If you are a woman of color, that date starts in July or August. Terrible, right? This is an issue we care deeply about at Mogul, and why we strive every day to destroy the inequalities that led researchers to project when parity will be reached in the United States, if we continue at the current incredibly slow rate of change. 2059 for Caucasian women, 2124 for African American women, and 2233 for Hispanic women, according to the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Harvard Business School was a place where I was confronted with these realities head-on. There was no way around it. The majority of my classmates were Caucasian men, much older than me. At HBS, they divide each class of 900 into 10 sections of 90 people each. These are the people you take your classes with, who make up your study groups, and with whom you have dedicated social outings. I was placed in Section J, or what a few whispers around campus came to call the married section. The average age of our class was about 27, but my specific section was composed of some of the most experienced in our class, people who had spent up to a decade in various industries, with families at home. This degree would enable them to reach the C-suite at their companies once they graduated. I immediately felt like an outsider. Not just an outsider, but also an imposter. What did I have to contribute to conversation? What did I know about running a business? I frequently felt like I had nothing to say. But I soon learned that I could allow my age to limit me, or I could nonetheless bring my perspective and remember that it too had value. Age, after all, is just a number. We all have had experience in living that allows us to form insights about businesses, business models, marketing strategies, and consumers. Whether you are the oldest in the room or the youngest in the room, age doesn't matter. You have to try to find a way to feel confident in yourself. You may have experienced more in your 25 years on Earth than someone who is 50, just because of the opportunities you weren't afraid to go after. And you can be 50 and be just as innovative and creative as someone just out of college, if not more. This is something I've faced my entire life. But don't let anyone look down on you because you're younger or older. It's natural to feel undermined when you are referred to as too young or green. But take the opportunity to prove them wrong and yourself right by continuing to speak up, sharing your voice and perspective. I would not be where I am today if I had allowed other people's assumptions about my experience, knowledge, and drive to slow me down. My willingness to go after opportunities, despite my young age, was most definitely an accelerator for me. I was always ready to take advantage of an opportunity, even when I wasn't necessarily the most qualified candidate. Address the elephant in the room with humor. When I was generally the youngest person in the room, and knew that age bias might work against me, I figured out a way to handle it when someone would ask my age. I would say, "I'm 40," with a smile, and they would laugh, because I did not look 40. If anything, I still looked 18. Then I would follow it up with a joke. "You just can't tell because I'm Asian." Now I'd put to bed two things that might have been elephants in the room, my age and my race. Let me tell you, people left me alone after that. Gloria Steinem once said, "The truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off." Once I faced the truth of my situation head-on, I was set free and used humor to diffuse a challenging situation. Humor is a great diffuser. Let them realize, through your humor, how irrelevant it is for them to even ask your age. Speak up. The truth is, I didn't have time to be shy and hold back at Harvard. I had to learn how to speak up, and I had to learn fast, because at HBS, up to 50% of your grade can depend on class participation. HBS is based on the case study method, where students read about a real-life business example, aka case study, and then the professor calls on students who have raised their hands to further discuss the predicament outlined in the case in order to arrive at a collective conclusion.